Thank you. You, my name is Howard, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you very much, Ralph, for all the work you've done to get this thing going and for inviting me to participate. I'm honored, and it's been a good 2 or 3 days. So, and Norm Alpie used to talk about coming to these things in order to renew some old friendships, which I have done, and to make some new ones, and I have done that also. So this, in that terms, it will be a success. Thanks to the speaker chairman who kept things moving and kept me informed, and anyway, thank everybody. Happy birthday to anybody that's having a birthday, and to all you mothers. Happy Mother's Day. Men and women. You're just going to start out getting in trouble. There ain't no use to tape for a man. Just get right in there. Some of you have heard me talk for 1,000 years. And I'm honored that they've asked me to talk again. I was born in Alhambra, California, 1,000 years ago. And I grew up in a little farm community in Wichita, Kansas. I don't remember anything about California until after we got out of high school. But I started out here. I learned largely to be the person that I was as a practicing alcoholic in this little farm community near Wichita, Kansas, and what we thought was the Bible Belt. Turns out that Oklahoma thinks it's in the Bible Belt. Texas thinks it is. Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota. That's not true. Everybody don't think they're in the Bible Belt. Los Angeles people know they are not in the Bible Belt, and I'm telling you, they're happy about not being in the Bible Belt. That was one of the great freedoms we found when we came to California, was out of the Bible Belt. Now, there's a lot of good things that went on there. During the Depression, we had free movies for the farmers. Now, I've had several requests about the baby elephant story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. And I saw this movie as a free movie in this little Kansas town, and it was partly about training elephants in India. And they took the baby elephants out of the herd, and they started their training by putting a rope around their right front leg and tying them up to a huge tree so that they could not get loose. And they pulled and tugged until their experience taught them to come to believe that when that rope's tight, it's futile to pull. Then they went ahead to the next phase of the training, but each subsequent phase included reinforcing this belief that when the rope is tied, it's futile to pull. So at the end of the movie, the big elephant was pulling trees out of the forest for harvest. And at the lunch break, in order to keep the elephant where they wanted it, they drove a relatively short stake deep enough in the ground that when they put the rope around the stake and the rope around the elephant's leg, he could walk around. He was free. But when he got to the end of the rope and the rope got tight, he couldn't pull against the tight rope. And as far as he was concerned, he was captured. The stake didn't hold the elephant. The rope didn't hold the elephant. What held the elephant was the limiting beliefs they had imposed on him when he was a baby. And I was in AA fairly new when Don Gates was talking about why he was the political party that he was with. And he had philosophical reasons and all that, but he said, that's all BS. The fact is, I'm what I am because my dad told me that's what he wanted me to be. And I got it, you know. And on the way home, I got that. I thought of the baby elephant. I thought, you know, you came into this outfit with 250,902 baby elephant beliefs, approximately. Just like that. Stuff that I don't even know I believe. But somehow, that's what I based my sense of well-being on. And one of the things was I was separate from God. God was an anthropomorphic being up in heaven. I've seen people from the lectern, not a podium. Podiums you stand on. This is a lectern, and we dump it off. we say, God help me, you know. And so we're separate from God. That's our consciousness, is we're separate from God. Chuck C. said that was our ego, and that's our basic trouble. That that our living problem, we have a living problem, and that is a conscious feeling of separation from God. And the living answer is a conscious feeling of unity with God. And in, you know, we've all heard this all weekend long. This is what the steps do, is relieve us from total self-centeredness to a gradual, progressive, spiritual awakening so that we're conscious of God in our lives. And But I started out separate from God. The only thing I had to do with God was to pray. And we prayed for it not to rain, and it rained that day, destroyed all the wheat in Sumner County, Kansas. And while nobody pointed the finger at me, I knew whose fault it was. I knew who wasn't being behaved so that God would answer your prayer. If you're 4 or 5 years old and you've assumed the entire responsibility for the wiping out the Kansas wheat crop, what you have is an ego problem. The old ego, it's going to make things happen that it lacks the power to make happen. And I am basing my sense of well-being on being able to make it happen. So I don't have that much of a sense of well-being. And there's nothing happening in my religious life that's very helpful. And when I'm 12 or 13 years old, I drink my first drink of whiskey. And it happened. You know, I found God. It was in the back of the big book. I just make up stuff and say that it's in the big book, and nobody ever checks. In the third edition, this would be on page 569. And it says, and what it describes is a spiritual awakening. A change of consciousness followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. That's the way the book describes a spiritual awakening. Now, do you remember your first drink? Remember what happened? A change of consciousness followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. The whole world changed, you know, and then it goes right back down the tubes. But that's the only time, you know, that's the only good feeling we knew how to have. So I started out, you know, I was in junior high school drinking whiskey, and once in a while I was always an alcoholic, but because I never controlled my drinking. But I wasn't a regular heavy drinker at that time, and I just drank to feel good, to have fun, to be somebody. And then a little later, when Pat and I got married, and I got a job as an entry-level engineer. Now, I had been a toolmaker. Toolmakers aren't under a lot of stress. But if you have to write technical reports, and you don't know how to write technical reports, now there's stress. And I discovered that if I drank whiskey, I had a technical vocabulary that I didn't know I had. The fact is, whiskey made me smarter. Much smarter, so that I could, and I went from a process analyst to an engineer to a senior engineer to an engineering manager, progressive series of promotions because I drank whiskey. And my speech got slurred, and so I added Benzedrine to my life. If you take Benny's, your speech is never slurred. You say the same things over and over really fast. But but then my life came apart. I was just in a lot of trouble at every place. Everything on page 8, it says quicksand stretched out in every direction. That was it. Every place was disintegrating, and there was nothing to stop it. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the very first night, I found out what an alcoholic was and knew I wasn't one. But the second half, this was at the studio group meeting over on, well, at this time it was in the women's club, which became the Sons of Norway, who we called the Sons of Bitches from only because they kicked us out. They bought the building and they wanted Friday for their Sons of Bitches meeting, and they kicked us out. So anyway, I on Overland we had the studio group meeting, and first meeting in the week was a beginners meeting, then a speakers meeting, and it was my home group, and I learned what alcoholism was, and I learned I wasn't one. The second half of the meeting was about God. And they read that part on page 94 of the big book that says, emphasize to the newcomer that whatever his belief in God is, that will work for him, provided it makes sense to him. Now, that rang my bell, and it still rings my bell. AA lets you have a God that makes sense to you. If it makes sense to you, it will work. That was a big, and the fact is, the gods that I had learned about earlier did not make that much sense to me. And of course, you will will yourself to assent that something is true, even though you know in this lifetime you don't have one opportunity to prove it. Because if you don't do that, you'll go to hell forever. Well, I'm doing it. I believe, but I didn't believe. And whiskey was doing it, now whiskey wasn't doing it. And God wasn't going to do it for me either. They talked about fake it till you make it. I thought, hell, I've tried that. That don't work. The doorknob. You know, old Joe's been sober 95 years, and his higher power has always been a doorknob. No kidding. And then they said, well, they wouldn't call on John. He'd hold his hand up, and you could see they ain't calling on him. And so as soon as somebody sat down, John stood up and said, my name's John, I'm an alcoholic. Oh, John. They also call me John the Baptist. And they call me John the Baptist because Jesus Christ is my higher power. Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior. And I ask Jesus to keep me sober every morning when I get up, and every night when I go to bed, I thank Jesus. And Jesus is with me every day, throughout the day. And I thank Alcoholics Anonymous for bringing Jesus back into my life. And I thought, boy, if you can kid yourself, you know, if you can con yourself into that fantasy, that'll work. But, you know, if it makes sense to you, but I can't live in that fantasy. I got to live in the real world, which that day was 4 half pints of whiskey and a lethal dose of benzodrine. And on the way out of that meeting, Leo had John the Baptist in the corner by the, and he was telling him, I told you don't bring Jesus into the meeting, you're going to scare away the newcomer. And I didn't go back and tell Leo, but I thought, hey, Leo, if you're not going to scare him away with the doorknob, I wouldn't worry about Jesus, you know. A week later, I proved to myself I was, my job a week later was to prove that I'm not an alcoholic. And I was just drunk and could not stop drinking because I was going to drink and not take another one. I got willpower. I was going to make this work. And for 4 days, I was out of the home on the streets, and I had a home, and I still had a wife and a job, which I was about to lose. When I finally could stop drinking, I've never wanted a drink since then. This was a very good thing for me. I'm not recommending it to anybody, but boy, I'll tell you, it sure convinced me I am an alcoholic. I know I'm an alcoholic, and I don't want to drink. And I come here, and I hear wisdom. And I heard Ski from San Diego say he was 36 years in learning that all the people that he hated didn't feel the hate. And it was killing him. Well, I'm going to take that home, and I'm going to stop hating people. After 2 days, I hated Ski for saying that. And I'm not working the steps. I'm not going to work the steps. And time goes by. But things are getting, you know. I'd stolen some equipment I took back. We owed money that Pat didn't know about. That I, you know, a lot of things started working early that we got resolved. And so life was getting better. But it wasn't, God wasn't in it. And then when I had about a year, and I started working the steps then, first I wasn't going to work the steps at all, then I was going to work the first, Leo, he was, whatever how many years he had, he worked the first step and the 12th step. But he worked the 13th too, but we never talk about that. He worked the first and the 12th, and he said, that's all I need. He said, that's all I need. And I thought, well, that makes a lot of sense. I'll stop drinking, and I will set the tables and chairs up. And I'm telling you, those are good things, and that's a good start. But it's it's not going to cut it. And then I'm going to do the 10th step. And the big book says, we watch for anger, selfishness, dishonesty, and fear. And when these pop up, we immediately ask God to take them away. And we make amends when necessary, when appropriate. You know how many times I was able to do that? None. None. I did not do that. I tried, and I made amends. She gets sick of that after a little bit. I'm telling you, if you want to make amends with her, do not tell her you're sorry. Stop doing what you're doing. Well, hell, I can't do that, but I can say I'm sorry. And hell, I'm not drinking. I have, you know. What the hell could she still be mad about? I'm not drinking. And but life is getting better. And along about a year, when I had probably a little less than a year, it became important to me to tell you, if you shared at a meeting about God answering a prayer, I would have to tell you after the meeting, God don't answer prayers for me. I don't pray. My God had the intelligence to create the entire universe. And that creation is still going on. And he doesn't need any input from me about how to create a universe. He don't need any input from me about what the hell I need in life. And besides that, God doesn't have ears. He's not an anthropomorphic being up in heaven. He's a spirit that underlies the totality of things. And nobody cared, Nobody cared whether I prayed or not, and they didn't stop praying because of it. But I told Frank, who was my sponsor, and the most spiritual man I've ever met. I don't know if he's the most spiritual I met, but he's the most spiritual man I've known. And he said, I hear you, Howard, but I never learned to pray effectively until I learned to meditate. Well, how do you meditate? Well, he said, there's 1,000, probably 10,000 books at the Bodhi Tree bookstore up on Melrose. But he said, the best thing I've found for alcoholics is chapter 11 in the 12 and 12. I said, I've read that. He said, well, read it again. He said, now, basically, he said, the big book tells us when we should meditate, and to some extent tells us how we pray and meditate. To some extent, it gives us the third step prayer, and the seventh step prayer. But he said, prayer and meditation isn't all that important in AA. We only do it when we're working any of the steps. And then on any given day, when you awaken, and when you plan your day, or when you're facing indecision, or as you go through the day when you're agitated or doubtful. Thy will, not mine be done. These are thoughts that must go with us constantly. Hell, that's probably 4 or 5% of the time, isn't it? About this matter of prayer, better men than us are doing it constantly. We constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. And upon retiring at night, except for that, prayer and meditation has no major role. He told me that on Tuesday and on Friday. He said, did you read that? Step 11 and 12. I said, yes, it's the... Yeah, I read it, Frank. Well, what did you think? Well, it's a St. Francis of Assisi prayer, which is just what I am not going to do. He said, is that all you got out of this? And I said, that's all there is in it, Frank. He said, why don't you come over tomorrow morning and let's go through that. And years later, in 1984, there was a book published called Pass It On. And so let's say long towards the middle of 1985, I got back to page 352. And from 52 to 354, they talk about Bill Wilson having 15 years to watch people come into AA, work the steps from the big book, get sober, stay sober, and remain angry, anxious, depressed, and filled with dread long after the high tide of active alcoholism has receded. And Bill wrote Father Dowling, and that's on page 354, is the letter that he wrote to Father Dowling where he said, I've written these essays on the 12 steps in the 12 and 12, not to change the step at all, but to deepen and broaden the experience of the old-timer and the newcomer alike. And my recent experiences, to work like the first step from the big book, and then work it from the 12 and 12. And then I'm also, although I'm not looking to Chuck Chamberlain's description on how to work the steps, but I'm looking for it for spiritual strength. I'm looking to have in my life what he describes. He said, if you guys paid attention, this would be on the first page, first paragraph of the second chapter. Golden Key, I think, is the name of the chapter. He says, if you paid attention to my talk last night, you may have the idea that we have a living problem which requires a living answer. But none of us, either alcoholic or non-alcoholic alike, can experience, in my opinion, the living answer without a personally satisfactory, conscious partnership with this very God that created us in this entire business of living. Entire probably includes half of it. Entire business of living. Now, it is, I had no idea when I first heard that and first, but that is kind of what I'm, that's not kind of, that's what I'm shooting for now. That's why I'm going through the steps one more time, is to, as I get to the experience, I want to accept this conscious partnership with God in His empire. And there's no way I can even come close to that without working the steps and practicing prayer and meditation the way it's described in the big book and the 12 and 12. So Frank said when that morning we looked at the 12 and 12, the first sentence was, prayer and meditation are our principal means of being conscious of God's presence. Now, he said, I know that you believe there is a God, whether you think he's in your life or not. If you think he exists, then just being conscious of his existence would be something very important. Would you want to skip the principal way of being conscious of that? Look at it this way. In the first step, you see that you lack the power, that you're powerless. In the first step, in the 12 and 12, it says, our admissions of our personal powerlessness becomes firm bedrock upon which we can build a happy, comfortable life. So when we have that bedrock, then we can look at the second step, which says, we come to believe that some power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And the third step, we decide to trust that. And the fifth step, it says, we feel the nearness of our Creator. And the seventh step, we surrender our entire lives, good and bad, to God's care. In the ninth step, we suddenly realize God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. If we work the steps, that's what we discover. If we're diligent about this, this is what we discover. And in the tenth step, it says we have entered the world of the Spirit. Now, if you're not going to practice, Frank said, the principal means of being conscious and improving your conscious contact, what the hell did you do the others for? You know, you're missing the payoff of the program without the essential prayer and meditation that strengthens our consciousness of this presence. And he said, we go a little bit and it said, prayer, meditation, self-examination, and prayer, taken independent of each other, will add great strength to your life. But if those three things, self-examination, meditation, and prayer, are logically interrelated and interwoven, they will form an unshakable foundation for life. Do you feel like your life is an unshakable foundation? Well, not exactly. Well. And then you go a little further, and he says, now he's talking about the St. Francis prayer here, and he says, you look at each word and idea, and you consider it its deeper meaning. He doesn't say we listen for it, but that's essentially what we're doing, is we are listening to see the deeper meaning of each word and phrase. Now, he said we could do the St. Francis of Assisi prayer, but I don't want you to do that, because I wasn't going to anyway. But he said, I know you know what the big book, how the big book describes alcoholics and alcoholism. And we'll call meditation being conscious of what you want to be conscious of. Now, I'm going to read to us this morning stuff from the big book that describes an alcoholic and the deeper meaning and alcoholism. Now, just be conscious, if you will, of the language used. And it won't take very long. So, alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. Deeper, the loss of control is characterized by an insane obsessive belief each time they start to drink that somehow, some way, this time it's going to be different. And coupled with that insane obsession is a physical reaction to alcohol that manifests itself in the phenomenon of craving for more once they start to drink. Alcoholics are restless, irritable, and discontented until they can once again experience the sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking a few drinks, comes at once from taking a few drinks. Drinks, which our insane obsession convinces us we can take with impunity. And when we succumb, as we always did, and the phenomenon of craving develops, we go through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolve never to do that again. Then we do it again and again and again. And over any considerable period of time, it gets worse. It never gets better, which leads in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Now, if you were conscious of those descriptions of alcoholics and alcoholism in way of if you feel, having listened to that, that that describes your experience with alcohol and alcoholism, we will call that self-examination. And because you found that that description really fits your experience, we just quietly, to the innermost self, I don't know any way to get to the innermost self without meditation. And the innermost self, we fully conceive to the innermost self that we are alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. And we did that. And I said, well, what about prayer? If that's meditation and self-examination, what about prayer? Well, he said, if you just will sit quietly and be open to the realization of how your life has changed since you stopped drinking, you may get a good feeling from that. That in the dictionary, gratitude is described as a good feeling that, well, isn't verbatim, but it's described as a good feeling that we get because something bad is taken away or something good is added to our lives. Now, if you just sit quietly and feel that, thank you, God, would be a prayer. But, he said, this is not a glass, this is not a table, and this is not a chair. Glass, table, and chair are words. These things aren't words. They're what they are, but they're not words. Thank you, God, is words. And if you are feeling grateful, don't leave that real thing to go to a word. Let God feel your gratitude. Let that be your prayer. And from time to time, when you do that, a good feeling will come up your body and leave goose pimples on your shins and the back of your arms and your hands and the back of your neck. And he said, that will be my higher power telling you, I felt your gratitude and you're welcome. And in that manner, Frank taught me prayer and meditation. And I'm telling you, it worked. You know, you can be very, if you get up in the morning and become grateful, just and admit you're an alcoholic, and then take the second half of the step and see that any problem you had yesterday and any problem you have today is simply going to be you are not having your way. That's it. There's no other problems around for us. That's it. We aren't having, if we also orient ourselves that will be acceptable, whatever the hell I'm given is acceptable. Now you're ready for it, but that's a way to start the day. And I did that, and I felt better. And so I didn't do it anymore. I stopped it. And then I talked to my sponsor, and I talked to Frank, and Frank, after a little while, would say, well, how are you doing with your meditation? I'll be damned. You're right. I never thought of that. I'd meditate again, and things would get good, and then I'd hit the old snooze alarm, and I was reading in step 7 in the 12 and 12, and I read the paragraph that says, sooner or later we have to stop using our higher power as some kind of a bush league pinch hitter. That the idea that of myself I am nothing. It's the Father within that does the work becomes our way of life. And I thought, God, you know, I'm doing that. I'm bush league pinch hitting it with my meditation. What I'm going to do is on the 1st of August, 1974, I made a decision that I'm going to meditate for 30 minutes every day for the rest of my life. That's the way I'm going to start my morning. When I first get up, I'm going to meditate for 30 minutes. No big deal, but I'm going to do it for the rest of my life. And therefore, I picked a 30-minute period, and I picked a meditation, which was going to be 6 months. By this time, I've gotten into Ram Dass, which isn't a bad thing to get into, but I was into Ram Dass, and I started out with the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Pat and I were coming up the grapevine, and she's asleep, and I'm Om Mani, and she wakes up and says, something's wrong with the car. I said, what's wrong? She said, I don't know. It's making a noise. Hell, we listen and we can't hear it. And she said, well, it's gone away. And so she laid back to go to sleep. And I said, She said, there it is again. Okay, after I did the then I did rum, 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 rum. For 30 minutes a day for 6 months. Then I did, believe it or not, the St. Francis of Assisi prayer for 30 minutes a day for 6 months, just to prove I could. And no, because you surrender and don't even know you're surrendering. And then I did my breath, where I was conscious of my breath coming in and going out. Going in, going out, going in, going out. You know what now? You know, and your mind wanders. It isn't if your mind wanders. When your mind wanders, you go out and you get it and you bring it back to the breath. Now you wonder, why in the hell would anybody be doing that? And Pat and I are driving. I'm driving her car, and I've got it in third gear. And I pull, and I'm not supposed to drive her car in third gear. I'm supposed to drive it in overdrive, fourth gear. Because if you drive in third, you tear up the transmission. And so I'm driving in third gear, and I pull off, and I gun it on the freeway, and it spins up a little with RPM, and she said, you got it in third gear. You're tearing up my transmission. I said, Pat, why don't you just shut up? Oh, I'm funny. Take me home. I'm not riding with you again. And my head is saying, why don't you just shut up? You don't know anything about transmissions. I'm the manager of a technical section in the systems engineering department. I have people that work for me who design transmissions. I don't know very much about them myself, but these guys... I mean, I know people that know. And you don't know. Now, my mind's going through this litany of BS, and all at once, okay, on page 88, it says, we alcoholics are an undisciplined lot, and we let God discipline in a simple way we just described. And I realize my mind is attacking her, and I disengage from that litany, and I engage the lyrics of a love song that describes our relationship from when we were in the seventh grade. And the lyrics to the love song are, you gave your hand to me and you said hello, and I could hardly speak, my heart was beating so. And anyone could tell, you think you know me well, but you don't know me. No, you don't know the one who dreams of you each night and longs to kiss your lips and longs to hold you tight. To you, I'm just a friend. That's all I've ever been. But you don't know me. For I never knew the art of making love, though my heart aches with love for you. Afraid and shy, I let my chance go by, the chance that you might love me too. You gave your hand to me and you said goodbye. I watched you walk away beside that lucky guy. oh no, you'll never know the one who loves you so because you don't know me. And she's broken up with this guy. And she married me. And we have three kids who have the best mother in the world. And I have the best wife in the world. One who without my life is empty. And who I love with all my heart now and then. And all at once, who cares what she thinks about the transmission in a Honda Accord? I mean, who cares? This is, you know, now, that's a tremendous thing. That's a tremendous thing that we get a discipline so that we can disengage from things that are not healthy to think about and engage stuff that is. And to believe the stuff that is, for that to be truth, because we practiced it. Now, someplace along the line, I heard Bob Corwin, who was, I think Sybil's eighth husband, but he was her last one. She stuck with him till the thing. I don't know if they did the love song or not, but they stuck together. And in his talk, Bob had, he was living in this hotel, and he was a salesman, and he got drunk in the hotel bar, and then while he was drunk, he went over and held up the clerk, the office at the hotel. And he said, Bob, and Bob put the gun on him and said, give me the money. He gave him the money. And he went up to his room and went to sleep, passed out. And our razor-sharp Los Angeles police found him. And they put him in jail, and he was in prison. And he said that that was the best thing that ever happened to me, because when I was in prison, I joined AA, and my home group in AA practiced love. Love does not be, he said, I stopped swearing, because love does not behave itself unseemly. I thought, I've heard that. I think it's Shakespeare. No, it's the big book. Well, I'll ask him. So I wait in line and move to the back of the line, move to the back of the line. If you want to talk to the speaker, get in the back of the line. And it's a simple little rule. Anyway, I got to Bob finally, and I said, did that love did not be saved itself unseemly? Does that come from the big book or Shakespeare? And he said, that comes from the big, big book. Uh-huh. He could tell from the look on my face that that was, you know. And he said, well, it wasn't really the Bible. It's a very tiny book by a guy named Henry Drummond. And it is a valedictory address that he gave to a group of graduating missionaries, in which he took for his thesis in this, the 1 Corinthians 13th chapter, prayer or letter on love. And as Pat told me that night, well, you have that book. Well, my mom had given it to me, and when I saw it was biblical, I put it away. And she said, it's still in the drawer. And I went and got it and skipped 1 Corinthians and read the essay. And I'm telling you, it is just something else. It's as good as Emmett Fox on any of Emmett Fox's stuff, although Drummond, for this, it was just beautiful for me. And then I memorized 1 Corinthians 13th chapter, 30 minutes a day for 6 months, you know. And I got where I could go through it. It's in three sections. And if I made it, when I first started out, I couldn't even make it. I could through the first section without my mind wandering. But eventually, I could go through the first. Now, once you make it through the first, that's it for the day. You don't have to look at the first again. And then you go through the second. Now, if something happens, you can go back to the first or the second. And then finally, the third. And then I got where, so help me, I could every day go through all three sections without my mind wandering. And then I could go back to the second section. Love suffereth long and is kind. Love envieth not. Love vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, thinketh not her own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoices not in iniquity, but rejoices in truth. Beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Love never faileth. Now, I would then love my life. I would start loving Pat. Not hard to do. Love Pat. Love my kids. Love the program. Love God. By this time, I can love God. And then I would say, okay, now, what Drummond says, instead of love suffereth long, he says love is patience. Patience is love passive. Patience is love just waiting in your heart to express itself when the summons comes. And love is kindness. Kindness is love expressed as you go through the day. If there's some kindness I can show another person, let me do it now because I may not pass this way again. And I'd go through this, and this would be the way I plan my day. I'm going to be loving today. And I'm driving down the freeway, and a guy cuts me off. Now, this is after I've been at this a while. But I'm telling you, he just barely missed me. And my honest to God spontaneous reaction was, man, I've cut people off, and I didn't mean to, and neither did you. You know, then, and life just changes. So that when anger, selfishness, dishonesty, or fear start popping up, you've got some place to go other than to anger. You've built new neural pathways so that you can go to love and patience. And any of those nine elements that make up love, any of those are appropriate when it hits the fan. You know, and I'm telling you, it isn't if it hits the fan, it's when it hits the fan. Which brings me quickly to page, I don't know what time we started, but it makes people feel a little more secure if you look at your watch. I felt better when he was showing you the sign last night. I thought, well, now he... I didn't see you do that, really, but I see you think it. So, now I forgot where I was, love and tolerance of others is our code. I don't know how I could have ever found a new pathway to live my life except through the steps and except by developing a discipline of because I'm automatically spring-loaded biochemically. We're in the top 15% in terms of the abundance of the neurotransmitters that activate the fight or flight center in your brain. I mean, you are spring-loaded biochemically for anger and anxiety. You've got a court low as far as dopamine and serotonin are concerned to activate the pleasure center. So you're shoveling it against the tide, shoveling sand against the tide, and the steps actually transform that. If you make a list of everybody you're angry with, and then you forgive them, All at once you've developed neural pathways that when this happens, I go to forgiveness. Where if I left it the way it was, when this happens, I go to anger. But we literally change the pathways. And it don't make any difference. Pat had a stroke nearly 2 years ago. She's had several of them, but with physical therapy, she has recovered from that. It takes work. That's the thing, you see. And Paige, when she read on page 84, 285, on page 85, the next paragraph after the one she read, it says, "It's easy to let up on our spiritual program and rest on our laurels." Okay? Now, the reason that don't work is because we do not have any laurels. Non-existent. And when we rest on our laurels, we're heading for trouble if we do. And I did that. You see, I did that. I retired. I had a good retirement. I had an opportunity to buy into a good business, dirt cheap, bought in. We made all of our investment back the first year. Every year after that, the least we made was 2 times our original investment. The most we ever made was 8 times our original investment. But that's a good buy, you know? So when you wake up in the morning, you meditate. But as you go through the day, you just kind of bite the bullet on stuff. And why stop when agitated and doubtful and get recentered? You know, I ain't got time for that. You just start letting up, and life is good. Seems to be getting better. That goes on from 1995 to 2012. And there's some people wanting to buy the business, and we ain't selling. And they say, they did say, we're going to buy the business. You're going to lose the business. We're going to put you out of business. Well, you ain't going to eat you either. Well, they did. That's what we call the law of probable dispersal. That law says whatever hits the fan will never be distributed evenly. It's also known as the why did it all land on me law. Now, I still meditate, and I was very active in the program. But I didn't do it the way I was doing it. Because I was resting on my laurels, and I'm telling you, I have no laurels. Now, no big deal. We sold the business. I forgave everybody, which didn't take me but 1 year and 1 afternoon. But the reason it took 1 year and 1 afternoon is because I had rested on my laurels. You see, and you've got to then work. I was good AA, and I recovered pretty fast, you know. Some from stuff I would have never recovered from. So, yes, but don't rest on your laurels. You're heading for trouble if you do. It isn't that if it's going to hit the fan, it's when it hits the fan. So, Pat and I have a good life. We have a great life. She's able to travel with me on my little rendezvous with you guys, and I'm very grateful that she can and does. We have a bucket list. We went to Mackinac Island on our 60th wedding anniversary. She saw this movie with Christopher Reeves called someplace in time. And it's on Mackinac Island, and we went to Mackinac Island. I played the part of Christopher Reeve. She's over there, deny. And we went, so a little bit after that, we went to Yellowstone. We flew up to Boise and got rented a four-wheel car and went to Yellowstone in the winter. And because she always wanted to, and that's what we did. And it was just a wonderful thing. Then we went to New York City. New York City. Into the second week of December. Oh, man, and the weather was good, and we went to the park and rode the buggy around the park and ran into Jerry Chmielewski. He stopped me on Fifth Avenue. There was 10 million people, and Pat says, let's get out of the crowd. The crowd, I can't walk good in the crowd. And then this guy grabbed me by the shoulder and said, Mister, could you tell me where the Empire State Building is? And I looked, and it's Jerry, who 30 years ago I was his sponsor. And he now has a five-bedroom home on Fifth Avenue across from the park. Wonderful lunch he bought us. And we wound that thing up with Radio City and the music. And the Rockettes. And it ain't just that they all kick in unison. If one of them winks, they all wink. If one of them does this, they all do that. They are great. And it was just a great, great trip. And we just have a great life. And the reason we have a great life is because we are looking and expecting a great life. Every morning, we got time for every morning? Okay, here's the deal. You join with me in this. It's just a third step prayer. But before, you know, before, when we address God in the third step prayer, let's stop, pause then, and be conscious of who we're addressing. We're addressing a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, which has all-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence that manifests precise law, order, harmony in everything that exists. Conscious of that? I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thy will. Then let's pause and know that everything in life we need to fulfill our purpose today is drawn into our lives, and we have been given the power and the knowledge to effectively interact with those circumstances and events. Practice patience, kindness, tolerance, and love. Being conscious of that and trusting that relieves me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Then we pause, and we know that God does not experience problems, difficulties, or unresolved circumstances. Those are products of my thinking, my actions, my efforts to control things that I lack the power to control. And now I want to know that God only is aware of order and harmony, which is personally acceptable in my conscious partnership with God in this entire business of living. Knowing that, takes away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love. And if you stop and just love your life, and if you really love your life, what you'll discover is God loves your life and you are face to face with God's love. May I do, love, thy power, and thy way of life. And what would God's way of life be? He graced his creation with his spirit for the goodness of his creation and creatures. So our way of life would best be to be of service to God's creation and creatures for their goodness. May I do thy will always. Amen. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Howard, so very much. And now we have a special treat.